Welcome aboard, Captain. Fighter pilots needed in Sector Wars. Play Astro Blaster.
R2 trying to increase the power.
Yahoo!
You're all clear, kid.
Friends, welcome back to the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast. I'm your host, Vic Sage, and if you happen to listen to our last episode, focusing on Bubble Bobble, I made a mention that we had something special planned for you this week. What that is the first of our mini-episodes, which I'm calling One-Ups. These will be special shows allowing me to share something about gaming in a digest-sized format. What I mean is, one week I might want to talk about Steve Cartwright, or answering listener questions about the Arcadia Retrocade, or, like for our first one-up offering, we'll be discussing the top 5 Imagic games for the Atari 2600. Like I just mentioned, the format for these one-up shows will be fluid, but the reason I chose to go with a list of top 5 Imagic games first was my own memories with that company, playing the titles on the Atari 2600 and in television of my youth. As I've mentioned on the Retroist site on a few occasions, as well as when Brett Weiss was kind enough to let me take part in his SNES Omnibus, the Super Nintendo and its Games Volume 1, back in 2018. As a kid, I spent a lot of time over at my grandparents'. Early on, I'm talking about the Atari 2600 here, it was pretty apparent that in my household that my father really didn't care for video games. At all. Now, my grandfather saw it all as a waste of time, but he wasn't down and out against electronic entertainment as much as my father was. Thankfully, I wasn't alone in my appreciation in video games. That was thanks to my grandmother. As I explained in my entry for Brett's book, there were games where we would kind of work in shifts to solve them. While I was in school, she would be playing, and when I got home, I would pick up where she left off. It got to the point where we started using a notebook, especially in later years, for games like The Legend of Zelda and then Super Metroid, etc. In the early days of the home consoles, once Activision had been formed and helped to open the door to third-party developers, in our household, we quickly learned to equate certain companies' names with quality products. Obviously, Atari was one of them, but right off the bat, with games like Pitfall and River Raid or Kaboom, it was evident that Activision games were worthy of our hard-earned money. That was equally true with another third-party developer known as iMagic. While they sadly didn't survive the video game crash of 1983, they did most assuredly release some nice titles for the Atari 2600, and even in television, as well as a few other games being ported to the ColecoVision, Commodore 64, and the TI-99, to name a few. One of the ways that both Activision and iMagic stood out on the shelves back then was thanks to their box art. Activision was highly colorful with their choice of game box color and feature rather stylized artwork on the front of the packaging. iMagic was stylized as well, but went with photographs and toy models for their cover art, like the plastic dinosaurs, spray-painted silver with missiles, and model jet wings glued onto them for demon attack. Hokey, sure, but if you look the cover up online, you'll see it's also pretty awesome. Plus, iMagic game boxes stood out on the shelves thanks to their highly reflective silver packaging. Even the cartridges themselves were different. Where the average Atari 2600 cartridge was basically a square, the iMagic games tapered to an edge, I assume making it easier to pull the cart out, instead of just grabbing the cart by the sides. To the handy Retroist Vault XJ13 computer here in the control room, in the number 5 slot for top 5 image games, we have 1982's Riddle of the Sphinx. This game was designed by Bob Smith, who had a hand in the release of 1986's arcade game Night Stalker for Ballet Cente, as well as the Parker Brothers port of Atari's Star Wars the arcade game. When I was mentioning my grandmother and myself working shifts on a game, Riddle of the Sphinx was the first game where we began to resort to that notebook, a gaming journal, if you will. In the game, you play the son of the Pharaoh of Egypt. Armed with a sling and stones, you have to travel the vast deserts in an attempt to reach the Temple of Ra. Riddle of the Sphinx is a vertical scrolling adventure game, where the player must collect as many treasures as possible. This is done by touching the traders who wander the desert with you. Doing so, you might gain or lose an item, like a shield to help protect you from the thrown stones of wandering thieves, who will also steal an item if they come in contact with you. Or you can use it as offerings at various locations, depending on the game's setting, like the Temple of Anubis in Isis, or even when crossing paths with the mighty Phoenix. Riddle of the Sphinx was played using two controllers. The right joystick controlled the inventory for the prince, much like with Howard Scott Warshaw's Raiders of the Lost Ark game by Atari. So, when the Phoenix was blocking your path, if you look through the manual, it read, quote, "The Firebird, newly risen from its ancient ashes, can provide you with a key to the riddle you seek to solve. You will know what gift to offer if you unroll and read the writing on your heart," end quote. Which means that you must offer up the scroll to the Phoenix, which will in turn gift you with a key. But you need to make an additional offering with another clue giving the hint that the first obstacle is rooted in relief, which means you also have to offer up the Tanis leaf. Now, if you don't have that in your inventory, that means you must head backwards in an attempt to find it, hoping to avoid those thieves and scorpions, or even the wandering and angry form of Anubis himself. Throw in the fact you have to worry about wounds and thirst. The result will cause the prince to move slowly up and down the screen, and he won't be able to throw his stones as far. You can see that the Riddle of the Sphinx had quite a bit to offer, especially for the time. Here's a fun fact. iMagic held a $1,000 contest for the game, for the player that solved the Riddle of the Sphinx, but provided the answer in a, quote, creative way. Well, that prize money went to Charles Compton, who delivered his answer on a scroll. The parchment was 12 feet long and written solely in Egyptian hieroglyphics. Number 4 is 1982's Cosmic Ark.
TV! Check. Cosmic Ark cartridge.
Check. Power!
Yeah, power!
Cosmic Ark is a game cartridge for the Atari video system.
Meteor! I got it!
The Cosmic Ark searches out strange creatures on distant planets.
Beam them up!
But the deeper the Ark travels in space, the tougher it gets.
It may never get back to Earth!
Boy, clean your room.
We're back.
Cosmic Ark by iMagic. The video system must be bought separately and connected to the TV by your parents.
Cosmic Ark was designed by Rob Fulop, who also had a hand in 1980's Night Driver for Atari, as well as the very successful port of Missile Command to the Atari 2600. In addition, he also worked on 1983's Demon Attack for iMagic, to name a few. Cosmic Ark is a sequel to another iMagic title, and that was Atlantis. The goal is for a player acting as the survivors of Atlantis on a mission to the Alpha Rho solar system to attempt to rescue as many alien life forms as they can before the sun goes supernova. To do so, a player must first survive a meteor shower. The Cosmic Ark itself is centered in the middle of the screen, and using your joystick, you must push in which of the four directions a meteor might appear to smash your space vessel. Each shot costs you a precious unit of fuel. If you successfully blast the meteor, though, you are awarded a fuel unit. If the Ark itself is hit, however, you will lose 10 units of fuel. You start with 40, I should point out. If you survive the meteor shower, you move on to the next stage, which is the shuttle ship rescue. You will see two strange animals cavorting on the surface of the planet below you. Pressing down on the joystick disengages the shuttle ship, and you must attempt to use your tractor beam to safely beam up the aliens and get back into the Cosmic Ark before the klaxon alarm sounds, signifying that a meteor is about to strike the Ark and destroy it. The larger vessel cannot defend itself until the shuttle ship is back in dock. This can get hairy in later levels, to say the least. This noble rescue attempt would be a little bit easier to accomplish if the planet didn't have a defense system that moves up and down on the left and right sides of the screen and fires at intervals, usually striking the shuttle ship when it's beaming up one of the animals. When the creature is safely brought aboard the shuttle ship, there's a little blip sound. And of course, you're trying to attempt to capture both of the beasts to get the most fuel back. If you do run out of time and that klaxon alarm sounds off and you are able to successfully defend the Ark, it will return to the very same planet so that you can rescue the other beastie. If the planetary defense system hits the shuttle ship, you will lose fuel, and the shuttle ship releases one of the creatures you've already captured for that planet. Here's a fun fact. Apparently, Rob Fulop revealed on his own blog that one of the reasons he created Cosmic Ark was to show both David Crane and Bob Whitehead of Activision that he could make a better Starfield effect. The Retrist Vault XJ Computer says that number 3 in our list goes to Dragonfire, originally released back on May 21st of 1982. This was another game designed by Bob Smith. Personally, I would have placed this in the number 2 spot, but I'm wise enough to not argue with the XJ13 computer in this case. Like with Cosmic Ark, Dragonfire is a game made up of two separate stages. The player must fill the shoes of the prince of a distraught kingdom that has been invaded by dragons, who, as they have been known to do, have stolen the treasures of the many castles of the kingdom for their own. So the player must try to first get the prince safely across the bridge of a castle, emerging from the safety of the castle tower on the right side of the screen and dashing across the bridge, avoiding fireballs shot across it, ducking the higher fireballs and jumping over the lower ones. This is accomplished, of course, by pulling down on the joystick to duck those fireballs, and to press the red fire button to jump over the lower ones. Once the prince is able to reach the safety of the castle on the left side of the screen, he enters the treasure room, or storeroom, filled with all manner of treasures like goblets, harps, glittering diamonds, and even lost crowns. The player must guide the prince over each object to pick them up, and when the last one is obtained, an exit will appear in the upper left-hand corner of the screen, leading to the next bridge stage, at a higher difficulty, of course. The prince can find safety in the lower left door of the stage, because the stalking dragon at the bottom of the screen isn't happy about being robbed, of course. It will hurl fireballs upwards at the prince as he races around the treasure room. I like to think I'm pretty good at Dragonfire. I believe I've shared some videos on the Diary of an Arcade Employee Facebook page of playing the game at the arcade. And let me tell you something, in later levels, it just gets nuts how quickly the dragon is hurling those fireballs at you. Number 2 on the list of top 5 Imagic games is 1982's Atlantis, designed by Dennis Coble. I hope I'm saying his last name correctly. Dennis had a hand in the 1977 Starship One arcade game for Atari, as well as Sprint 2 for Key Games, aka Atari. In addition, a few other notable games include Shootin' Gallery and Solar Storm for iMagic. I might have to tackle Starship One on the regular podcast in the near future. It certainly has a beautiful cabinet design. When you get time, make sure to check it out. Atlantis has some elements of Atari's Missile Command, in that in the game, you have to protect cities from attack. In this case, though, you must man the defense installations of the mighty Atlantis, protecting the Aqua Plain, Domed Palace, the Bridge to Bazaar, as well as their shield generators from the red-hot death beams of the invading Gorgon fleet. The good news is, unlike Missile Command, you need not worry about the defense installations on the left and right sides of the screen. The Gorgons won't attack those. They will, however, take out the middle installation, as the manual explains it is the Acropolis command post. Using the joystick, when you press to the left installation will fire. Pressing the joystick to the right will release a blast from the right installation, and pressing the fire button shoots off a round from the command post in the center of the screen straight up into the air. Hitting any of the Gorgon fleet with the Acropolis command post won't get you as many points, since it requires more strategy to hit them with the left and right installation posts. The Gorgon fleet appear at the top of the screen and travel across from either the right or left-hand side. If they safely reach the other side of the screen, they will drop down one level. When they reach the bottom of the screen, the fourth lane if you will, they will unleash their death ray, and it will destroy one of the places in the city you're attempting to defend. Besides the two Gorgon vessels, one which looks a little like the Starship Enterprise, and the other vaguely resembles an Imperial Star Destroyer from Star Wars, there is the Buzz Bomber, which is incredibly loud when it appears, and travels quite a bit quicker than the other ships in the Gorgon fleet. Taking it out will cause it to explode, and the screen quickly flashes, but that will also take out all the other ships on the screen, even though you only get the points for the bomber. Trust me though, in the later stages, the fleet ships are zipping along the screen, and the bomber is really the only way to keep your head above water. By the way, the reason fans know that Cosmic Ark is a sequel to Atlantis is that at the end of the latter, you see a shuttle ship escaping the destruction of the fabled city. Plus, at the very back of the manual for Atlantis, there is a message that reads, "Atlantis, its last installation devastated, explodes in a fury of fire and radiation." But wait, a satellite streaks into space. Where is it bound? Has someone survived the Gorgon onslaught? Can the Cosmic Ark repopulate the ocean metropolis? The saga continues. Sadly, there was no such message at the end of the Cosmic Ark manual, which is a shame. I would have loved to have seen where the series might have been headed next. Alright, friends. We've reached the number one position for the top 5 iMagic games for the Atari 2600, and it goes to 1982's Demon Attack by Rob Fulop, a game I should add that Atari found to be too similar to Century's Phoenix arcade game, one that Atari had paid for the exclusive rights to port to their systems. Apparently, they sued iMagic, and it was settled out of court. Nonetheless, iMagic scored a major victory with Demon Attack. It was their highest-selling title for 1983, and even took home Best Video Game of the Year from the staff of Electronic Games, with a quote in the magazine reading that Demon Attack, quote, "turned out to be a yardstick against which gamers measured the quality of each new cartridge during 1982, end quote. It's definitely a great game. Although, let me say right now that as good as it is, when it was ported to the Intellivision, they really knocked it out of the park. I should know. My grandmother liked the Atari one so much, she bought the Intellivision version when we found out there was a second stage added. Demon Attack tasks players with piloting a laser cannon on the icy planet of Krybor. Marooned, you are only attempting to survive each new wave of demons who are trying to bomb your laser cannons out of existence. The joystick allows a player to move right and left, and the fire button allows you to fire off a missile upwards. Unlike in the Phoenix arcade game, hitting one of these alien-looking demons anywhere as they swoop lower and lower towards your laser cannon will destroy them. There are different versions of the demons. Some will attempt to drop bombs on you, and others fire off streams of lasers at the ground that players will have to dodge to the side to avoid getting hit. Then, in later stages, there are some demons who will transform into smaller versions and try to kamikaze into your cannon. Actually, when the game was first released, it was discovered that after Wave 84, the game ended. The screen just went blank and emitted a harsh sound. It turns out that Fulop didn't expect anyone to be able to reach level 84. This was obviously fixed after the first batch was sold out. Rob altered a line of code that allowed the game to continue indefinitely, but wouldn't progress in difficulty after Wave 84. In fact, over on Atari Mania, I found an awesome letter from iMagic to one Dave Rout that reads, "Dear Dave, congratulations. You've become one of the select few who have survived 84 waves of demon attack. Your television will go blank when the demons surrender, so try a new assault. Turn power switch off, then on, and select the game you wish to play. For maximum challenge, try A difficulty level, games 5, 6, 7, and 8. Becoming a Demon Attack expert entitles you to the enclosed Demon Attack poster, and of course, the thrill of beating one of the roughest, toughest games around. Sincerely, Kathleen Booth, Consumer Affairs. P.S. The high-pitched sound you hear is just because of where the sound program in the cartridge ended. No need to worry. I'll be sure to include a link to Atari Mania for this podcast post on the Retroist. Okay, friends. I think that brings us to the end of this first 1UP episode. It was interesting to see what the Retroist Vault XJ13 computer came up with for the top 5 games. I'd love to hear what your favorite iMagic games might have been. Feel free to leave your thoughts in the comments on this podcast post on the Retroist. And I do hope you will bear with me as I try some different things for these mini episodes. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen to the show. The Diary of an Arcade Employee is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and even Spotify. So, if you have a moment, why not subscribe and help us get the word out on the show by leaving a review and some comments? Helping the podcast reach new listeners is always appreciated. You can find out more about the Arcadia Retrocade by visiting Facebook, or for daily posts, you can check out the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast Facebook page. I share all manner of vintage arcade and home console fun multiple times a day. If you have any feedback or comments about the podcast, you can always reach me on Facebook or throw me an email at vicsage@retroist.com. You can also find me posting videos of the arcade on my Instagram account, which is simply vicsage_. I, of course, want to thank the Retroist, not for just hosting the show, but for providing a spot on the internet where you can visit throughout the week to find some of the best retro-related articles and podcasts. Now here's a hint on what I'll be talking about on the next show. This has been a Retroist production. Thank you for listening, and have a better one. Goodbye.
End of line.